Okay, we are at 7:30, so I'm going to go ahead and mute all. As always, everybody has the ability to unmute themselves. Please feel free to do so. If you have a question or comment, remute yourself afterwards. And later on this evening, courtesy of Alan's hard work, we will have the contents of the deck in PDF format. The audio track and the contents of the chat window will go up on our website. So look forward, if you are a member of the OPCUG member form, you will get a notice once those are posted. Otherwise, check in a couple of hours after the meeting, and they will probably be available. Welcome all, especially to any guests that we have with us tonight. If you are a guest and you do want to join our group, it's just $20 a year. If you, I pasted the link into our chat window, but you can also go to our homepage and just click on the Join or Renew button at the top left or top right, and that'll step you through the process. And so we got quite a few things on the agenda tonight. Hopefully we'll have some time for the last 10, but if not, we'll see. We'll plow through. So we'll turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, so we have things categorized, but the first one fits into two categories. And last week, or a couple of weeks ago, we were actually talking about the Windows 11 Start menu. And Harvey had mentioned that he uses something called Start 11 as a replacement. And so this is actually a YouTube video from Leo Notenbaum about the Start 11 menu. And I think I haven't watched the video, but Harvey knows all about it, so he'll say a few words, I think.
All right, thanks, Al. Start 11 is the name of the product, and of course, the company that develops this is called Stardock Corporation back in 1991. They were incorporated in 1993 as Stardock Systems. And the name Start 11, the number 11 essentially relates to the Windows version that you're using. Now, I've been using this product for 14 years, so back when Windows 8 came out, that was in October of 2012, I actually had clients call me who had purchased new computers. It did have, of course, Windows 8 on it. They said, I don't know how to navigate Windows with the menu that they're providing. And as you can probably relate to the Windows menu, it can be sometimes overcomplicated, and so I got them onto the product. Back then, it was called Start 8. So that's a Windows graphical user interface replacement, the Start menu replacement. So they then could work with their computers much easier. Now, I'm going to share my screen if I can.
Well, just a second.
Yeah, okay. Hopefully I
okay,
can...
you should be able to do it now.
Let's have a look here. One sec. Let's see if I can get it off this screen here. Uh-oh, can't. No, I can't get it. I only see the Zoom screen. You see this screen up here. Let's see. Let's try it. All right. We got it now.
Yep.
All right. Now, I have the Start 11 on my machine. So down in the bottom left is the Start button. Now, it's configured to give me a menu that is similar to what I call Windows 7. If you're all familiar with that, but it gives you everything that you can think of. If I was to use the built-in menu, this is what I would see. And it's, you know, some people like it, some people don't, that type of thing. So if I click on the Start button, this is the Start 11 software that has been configured for it. And, of course, it's no different than anything else. If you hover on all programs, it gives you the whole list. that type of thing. You can pick and choose whatever you want to do. It'll give you a list of recently used programs, and that's something that's always been available in the so-called Windows 7 menu. Now, if I type in here, for example, Start 11, it comes up with the application. Now, you're going to see this particular screen in Leo's presentation, and he's going to go through all of these configuration items in the left column. So you can see I've already got mine set. It's set as a Windows 7 style, that type of thing. The Start button, well, it doesn't show well in here, but that's what the Start button is. That taskbar, if you've got anything you want to do or work with in the taskbar, you can do that, etc., etc., etc. So, it comes in handy in the control section. If I want to see and use the Start 11 menu, I just click the Start button, and it automatically will open up that menu. If I want to use the Windows menu, I just depress the Windows key, and that'll give me that menu. So I just wanted to cover off that. I think I can get out of here now. One sec. There we go. We're back. And so just to mention, like every year, like Windows 10 came out in 2016, and so Start 10 was released. Windows 11 came out in October of 2021, and that's when Start 11 came out. Now, the software is approximately $8 US, but it gives you a lot of options and things that you can do with it. So have a look at that presentation, and he goes over it very well. And if you think you have more questions, just send me an email. I'll be glad to respond and help you out. Thanks.
Okay, thanks very much, Harvey.
All right.
Yes, I remember the menu for Windows 8. That was the one that had tiles everywhere.
Yeah.
And the one that I had to go to Google to find out how to turn off my computer.
Yeah, the whole menu system back then was just so terrible. And I was shocked that the clients would say, I don't know how to use my computer. They just couldn't navigate it. Anyway, there we go.
Okay, thanks again.
All right.
All right, so next up we have a number of questions from a member. And these originally came in as a one-on-one request for remote assistance, but it turns out none of them really lend themselves to somebody logging onto a computer and viewing somebody's screen and seeing what's going on. And most of these things I actually don't have a clue how to deal with, so we are asking for your assistance. So if you have any bright ideas about the next bunch of slides, put something in the chat, raise your hand, open your microphone, tell us how to respond. So the first one was that this individual has a Samsung tablet, clearly an old one, around about 2015. She says it's lovely but rarely used, and what should she do? And my suspicion here is the problem is that Android system is going to be way out of date and there will be no security patches for it. So I'd be a bit concerned about using it for the internet, for example. But it might make a good e-reader. Anybody have any bright ideas what to do with a 2015 Android tablet?
Depending on the size, she could use it as a picture display.
As a what, sorry?
Picture display. You can put her pictures on, and instead of bringing a big computer, she could bring the tablet to show people her pictures.
Yep, okay.
Besides your suggestion of the e-reader.
A portable image viewer, right.
Yeah.
Okay, next up, She has a 2006 laptop that was being used until a few years ago when she left the power cord dangling out of the car, and I think something got destroyed. She says that the laptop would work perfectly if she could but charge it, but she has a bunch of multi-pronged adapters, but none of them will work. So where can she get an appropriate charger? Yeah, my thought here was something like the Trailing Edge. I don't know whether they say that they supply parts, so I'm assuming that they may have a basket full of adapters, power blocks, and you could find something that would be useful.
Amazon would be a possibility as well. Just feed in what the exact make and model is of the laptop, and power adapter, and I wouldn't be surprised if something comes up.
Another good one to check would be Sayall, S-A-Y-A-L. It's an electronic warehouse where they have enough electronic components in there you could build darn near anything.
To add to what Chris said, Amazon also sells a universal one with...
You muted yourself, Dave.
Fix many wires using soldering iron, if that's all it is.
With an adjustable one, you might have the problem of putting in too much voltage or too little, which might damage the laptop. But use the specs of the laptop to find an appropriate power adapter. It doesn't have to be the same make, but it should supply the same amperage and voltage.
And have the right connection, I guess.
Well, you'll find out that quickly enough. Bring your laptop with you.
Yeah, they're probably mostly barrel connectors, aren't they, back then?
The older ones were, yeah.
Still are. I'm using a laptop connector. Oh, dear. I've outed myself.
Okay, next up was some kind of headset. I assume it's a Bluetooth headset, and which she wants to synchronize to a smart TV. How would you actually go about doing that?
Well, your TV needs that Bluetooth.
Even if your TV has Bluetooth, often they don't have the audio. You can't put out audio over the Bluetooth. So look in your manual, and if you don't have your manual, then search for it online to see if you can switch it to Bluetooth or go through the menus maybe. If it is Bluetooth, if it's wired, then you can just plug it in.
Yeah, I would definitely find the manual for both the TV and the headset, and with the pair of them manuals, you should be able to figure out whether they are designed to be able to connect, and if so, how.
So if it's wired, do you have to synchronize it?
No.
Yeah.
It should just output on the wired connection, period.
Yeah, that's why I thought it was probably Bluetooth, because it's just synchronized. Okay, and then the last item is...
Another possible solution is if you have a Roku adapter for your TV, then it has an audio out on the remote control that you can use.
Good point.
Okay, so the last piece of equipment is a Surface Laptop Go 2, which she says doesn't have an operating system. And so she's looking for... A compatible operating system for a Microsoft Surface that she says can be purchased outright. Now, Chris and I found this kind of odd. A Microsoft Surface laptop, pretty sure that would have come with Windows. So where did Windows actually go? And of course, you all know what my solution to this one is, and just install Linux. And Linux Mint is very much like Windows, the Cinnamon Edition anyway, and it will actually run on a Surface, and it's free, so that's an even cheaper solution. So anybody else have any other bright ideas for a Surface laptop?
Just Linux.
It may depend on which generation of Surface laptop, because the earlier ones use some kind of RISC processor, like an ARM processor. Later ones, I believe, use some kind of Intel-compatible chip.
She said that this was a Laptop Go 2, Tom, and I checked that one actually does support Linux.
Yeah, so Linux, it seems very reasonable to me.
Was there anything else in the chat, Chris? I wasn't following that.
No, just some questions about whether it was Intel or RISC-based, and was it Surface RT, which is ARM-based, I believe. So, yeah, the question is up there. It definitely should have originally come with Windows, for sure. So, you know, if you wanted to stick with Windows, it should be possible to get Windows on it again.
Okay. All right. So following up on the idea of Linux, I also came across this video recently. And it's basically a YouTube video again, about 20 minutes, just under 20 minutes, and talks about the birth of Linux and how it started off, you know, Linus Torvalds and all that good stuff, and how it evolved over the years. And it's quite an interesting video if you have any interest in how Linux was developed over time. Okay, next up, Chris has got some information on spam emails or scam emails.
Yeah, so this came in into a suggestion box, and Peter said that he got an email in his inbox. He suspected the attachment is a trap and wanted a second opinion on it. I could have just said pretty quick and easy that if this is unexpected, then it's a scam. And then I thought, well, let's look at it just a little bit more closely. How do you actually determine that things like this are a scam? So first off, you know, it came from top-level domain name of .br. So that's Brazil. Well, that's a little bit suspicious right there. I'm not likely to be doing business with anybody in Brazil. Next thing is the 2 on this. You were BCC'd on this email. So the 2 is actually one of their email addresses. But think about it. If you're being sent an email very specific to you because it's talking about payment details, so it is a specific transaction that supposedly you actually had with them, why would they not address it directly to you? Why would they BCC you on this email? In all likelihood, it means it went out to thousands of people at the same time, and so they just wanted to hide the fact that it went out to multiple recipients. Then we have a generic greeting, hello. You know, typically, again, if it's something that is a specific transaction you had with them, you know, they might greet you with hello, Chris, or whatever. Need assistance, call a phone number. Well, it turns out that 806 is not a toll-free number. It's area code Texas, but the email came from Brazil. You know, so, again, things are just not looking like they match up. And then it has an attachment. And so attachments are often used to try to infect the recipient's computer. So if you double-click on them, they will trigger something. It'll either be an executable that'll run, or it'll be, in the case of a PDF file, it might be looking for a vulnerability in Adobe Reader. And if you open up a specially crafted PDF file, it'll trigger that vulnerability in Adobe Reader or whatever. So PDF files are very, very commonly used as an infection vector when you're trying to attack computers. So I thought, you know, it's about 99.99% sure that it's a scam, but I thought, okay, well, let's just take it a little bit further. So I saved the attachment to disk, which is not a dangerous operation. If it is an infected executable or something like that, your antivirus might pop up and tell you, oh, this is malicious, and you know right off the bat. So nothing popped up from my antivirus, so I submitted it to VirusTotal. And it was not reported as malicious by any of the antivirus engines at VirusTotal. So then I submitted it to an online service to convert it to plain text so I could see what was in this PDF file. There's no way I was going to open up this PDF file on my computer. So I converted it to plain text, and I did it through a free online service, so I just had to upload it there. They gave me back plain text, and this is what I actually got. And so, you know, just thank you for your payment, transaction date, the amount. Please retain this document. We appreciate your business. And, oh, thank you for choosing McAfee_TM. Kind of weird. And, you know, it's an official receipt. So my conclusion is they're probably trying to get you to actually call the phone number. Okay, and then the scam would actually take place. So they would try to convince you to, I don't know, give up credit card information or who knows what. And then, but really, I mean, I would not go to that sort of extent on this. I think there was enough evidence that the email was a scam, and so I would just delete it. And if you want, check out the OPC UG Fraud Watch page for similar type things on how to deal with these sort of scams in the future. And yeah, that's it.
Glenn's asking, how did you know that it was a BCC email?
Well, my email address didn't show up on the 2 or a CC line, so it had to be a BCC.
Presumably you could have checked that if you'd opened up the headers, right?
Yeah, but I think any email program will show it if you are either directly addressed, it'll show up on the 2 line, or if you're CC'd on it, it'll show up as well. It's only if it's BCC'd, I believe, that you won't see your email address. You'd definitely see it if you were directly addressed, and I believe you would see it as well if you're CC'd.
Okay, next item is yours too, Chris.
Okay.
Email addresses.
Yeah, okay, so this is a little bit of a lengthy one, but I came across some interesting additional capabilities here that I thought I'd like to pass on. And just to go back a little bit for anybody who did see the original presentation, February 11th, Alan and I did a tag team on the ins and outs of electronic mail. And part of it was talking about disposable email addresses. And these are really useful if you don't trust somebody that you have to give your email address to, or you don't trust them yet. And so what you can do is give them a disposable address that will deliver the email to your real address without exposing your real address to the person. And then you can get rid of those disposable addresses if you decide you never want to hear from that recipient again. So the February presentation showed how you could use National Capital Freenet for disposable email addresses. It's very easy to set up. It's actually not an unlimited number. It's 100 disposable email addresses that you can create, and you can get an email-only National Capital Freenet account for $12 a year, which I thought was a reasonable price for supporting an organization that's doing good work in the community, as well as giving me the ability to use disposable email addresses. So then I updated the content for the Ottawa Public Library presentation, Taming the Inbox, Organizing and Stay Safe, and I'll go through a little bit of that. So when trust is lacking, so often when you go to use some kind of online service and you want to download a report or you want to use some area of the website that's not normally visible or use a service on a website, something like that, and you may not trust the company yet. You may not be familiar with them, and you might be worried they're going to sell your address to spammers or scammers. They might send you all kinds of junk into your inbox, and they might just refuse to honor any unsubscribe requests so that you continue to get these piling into your mailbox. If you use your real email address, you could get inundated with spam or scams, and it could be impossible to get them to stop sending you spam. Not a good situation. So a National Capital Freenet, again, 100 disposable email addresses. NCF assigns you a unique ID onto your account, and then you assign a unique prefix for each service or whatever that you're using. So I had an example of Bob's Emporium, and I could use prefix of Bob's Emporium or BE, Bobby, A, whatever I wanted. And then it creates that email address that is the prefix that you give it plus the unique ID for your account. And that's a valid email address that points to your email address. So on NCF, you go to their start page, you click on disposable email addresses, you put in a prefix and a description if you want one. So if you use something like BE, you might not know 6 months ago or later, what was BE actually referring to. And so you can put it in a description as well if you want. And then it creates that disposable email address. And then when you're asked for the email address at Bob's Emporium, you give them that email address rather than your normal NCF email address. All the email that gets sent to that email address will get delivered to your email box. You'll be able to see that it was actually addressed to that rather than your NCF account. you can create rules on how to deal with and so forth if you want. And you can use that forever if they turn out to be a trustworthy place. So here's the first email I get from Bob's Emporium, and he's offering me 50% off my first order if I reply. Well, that sounds like a good deal, but I still don't trust Bob. And so if I reply, by default, it's going to come from my primary email address. But if I click on the chevron, I can choose from any of the disposable email addresses. So in this case here, I would choose the bobsemporium.bpuz9@ncf, and then I send it off. And then I get a reply back from Bob. He says, thanks, you can expect 10 emails a day, and it's going to take 30 days for us to remove you from our listing. Obviously Bob's Emporium was not trustworthy. I don't want to deal with this company at all anymore. I go back to the start page, disposable email addresses. I find his entry, and I click on delete, and I will never see any emails again from Bob. So the benefit is I never expose my real email address to Bob. Okay, since then, I come across another couple of services that for free you can actually have disposable email addresses. Yahoo will allow you to have 3 disposable email addresses on free accounts. If you pay for plus accounts, you can get up to 500 disposable email addresses. So in Yahoo Mail, you go to the settings on, under the More menu, and you go to Mailboxes, Disposable Email Addresses, Add, and then you create the permanent nickname that is associated with your account. And so you put in whatever you want rather than NCF does it where they assign a unique ID to yours. You create one, and then you create a suffix for that. And so it gets combined with that. And then you have your 1 of 3 in this case. And then your first email comes in, and 50% off if I reply. So by default, if I reply, it'll be coming from my normal Yahoo email. So I click on the from, and I'm able to choose a disposable email address, send that off. It'll be from Bob's Emporium, and you know the unique ID that's a disposable address. And if I never want to hear from Bob's Emporium again, I delete the disposable address. And again, Bob never knew my real address. Outlook.com allows you to have disposable email addresses called aliases. And there's weird sort of limits on this. So you can have a maximum of 10 aliases at any given time. You're limited to creating 10 new aliases per year, so you can't cycle through them, you know, 1 a week if you're so inclined. You can add a maximum of 2 new aliases within a rolling 7-day period. And then once deleted, an alias can never be reused. So that's it for the update to that, I believe.
Okay, thanks, Chris.
Yeah. And I see some things that Flurry's come in.
Natalie is asking if the NCFS disposable address is available to choose as a drop down on any email server for Gmail, for example.
If you're using Gmail, you'll be limited to. And Gmail doesn't have disposable email addresses, so you could not change it to something else. You would have to be sending from. I believe Gmail will prevent you from saying your from is actually an external email address.
One thing I use is the DuckDuckGo add-on in different browsers, and it allows you to create unlimited free addresses to use in the browser. And if you reply from your usual email, it seems to come from the free address. You can delete the address and manage them. And also trackers are deleted when the email gets to you. So that's what I've been using.
Okay, good.
So when you were using the drop-down, Chris, that was in Thunderbird, right?
Yes, that was in on NCF, it was in a web browser. But Thunderbird, I wouldn't be able to do it. It was in web browser was what I was using on those.
Okay. Okay.
Proton Mail can create aliases as well.
It's not free, is it?
Yep.
Oh, okay.
Okay, next up we have a share from Jose Costa. He's been keeping a list of various free tutorials that he comes across. And basically what he's done is created a spreadsheet. So here you'll see some of the people who are developing the videos that he uses. You'll recognize some of the names there, I'm sure. Leo Notenboom, for example, we talked about tonight already. And what Jose does is when he finds a video that he likes, he records the information about the video and the link and the time duration of the video. So you can always go back to these things. A, it's searchable because it's a spreadsheet, and B, he can always go back to the video just by control clicking on the link. And one of the ones he had, which I thought was interesting, I've never used it myself, it's called Tutorials Point, and it says that it has more than 1,200 free tutorials in all kinds of different categories. So if you need to know something about something, then that might be a good place to go look and see if there's a tutorial on the item that you're particularly interested in. Okay, next up, Chris, a share on battery health. Well, from Stuart.
Yeah, actually, this is a sort of tag team, I believe, on this. I think the first couple of slides are actually ones you put together, Alan.
Oh, okay, right. Yes, all right. Yes, Stuart sent this in, and he's talking about Samsung and the fact that one of these things that the Android phone suppliers have a captive market, and they only give you security patches for a limited amount of time. It used to be 3 years, now for some phones it's up to 7 years. But eventually your security patches run out, and you have a problem on your hands, I guess. And he wants to extend things, so one of the ways to do that is keep the phone alive, and one way to keep the phone alive is to make sure the battery still works. And he's got an article here from XDA, which is one of these development organizations that generate custom ROMs, for example, and on how to extend the battery life. And he said he actually tried one of the recommendations, which was stopping the unnecessary apps running in the background, and he found that okay. But in the meantime, Chris had actually gone back to the source and has some information about the actual process.
Yeah, so I went through watching the or looking at the article, and just highlighted a couple of things on it. So, the person was upset that it was draining over hours, and they found that they couldn't even get a whole day's use out of the phone. And so here's the things that they actually looked at: tweaking always-on display behavior, changing the performance profile, and they said light mode was enough for me, which I thought was kind of odd because dark mode would actually save more battery life. Stopped unnecessary apps from running in the background. That's always a good thing to do because any running app is going to consume a certain amount of battery. Switching off 5G in weak signal areas, I had never thought about that one. And so if you are in an area that doesn't have very good 5G coverage, why be searching for it all the time? And then controlled syncing and background activity, so unused accounts and things like that, they could be consuming, not only your battery life, but also using airtime and things like that. And so the results, and I thought this was a telling thing. So there was no one obvious battery problem. It's all kinds of little things that were adding up to being a problem. And so going through it, all the ones that this person recommended, none of them ruined their experience or stripped away any features that they figured were important on the phone. And that's really the important thing, is look for the features you need. So don't just go and automatically blindly turn off all of these things that may save your battery life. Some of them you want them turned on because it's providing functionality for you. It's why you have your phone. So start with features that you don't use or very rarely need, and then take a look. Does it help? Does it hurt? and switch anything back if it actually affects your daily workflow. So that functionality that you want on your phone, then make sure that that's still enabled. And I think, beyond the Galaxy, this is good advice for any phone. Look for features that you don't use and turn them off, and they may save you battery life. That's it.
And Tom's noting that dark mode only saves you power if you have an OLED display, not an LCD.
Ah, good to know.
And Stu says, Chris misspoke. Performance mode is not screen mode.
Okay, all I did was I was reading the article.
The article misspoke, Stu.
There you go.
Yeah, I think they were referring to performance mode, like how hard the CPU runs. Is it race car or family van or grocery store buggy?
Yeah. So that's one of the things that you might want to decide. Do you want that extra performance or do you want to save battery life? It's your choice, and you're trading things off. And Harvey mentions a phone limited charging up to 80%. My Android has that as well, and that's a good thing to extend the overall life of the battery so it'll last many years as opposed to how long it will last on a single charge. And so I do recommend that to people that, if at all possible, limit your charge to that 80%. If you know you're going to be away for a period of time, you could override it, charge it up to 100% for that day, but then go back to 80% when it's under your normal circumstances.
Laptops also have that capability too.
Some of them, yeah.
And if you have it plugged in all the time, you can actually set that limit to 60% instead of 80%. So your battery will last a lot longer.
I heard an interesting phrase the other day, and it was referring to the 100 million different little things that we can do to improve or degrade our batteries. And the comment was that, yes, batteries don't degrade. They're murdered by the way we use them. So treat your battery better, people.
Good point.
David, did you have a comment there?
No, you did not.
Okay. All right. Next up is another item from Stu from the dark side of the world. I think he only does this to make those poor PC people jealous. And he says it's only for Mac users. It's a utility from the UK called WattCable. And it's kind of interesting. It actually tells you what the cable that's plugged into a port on your Mac computer, remember it's only for Mac computers, what the cable actually does. And Stu's got an example here of he's got an external USB plug in, a solid state drive, and it's telling him that he's got a USB 3.2 Gen 1 running at full speed, 5 gigabits per second, et cetera, et cetera. So, and he said he could probably get a faster connection if he had a better cable, so I presume he's going to go through his stack of cables here with this thing and find out what they all do. Okay, next up, Chris has keyboard shortcut number 16.
Number 16. I'm going to go beyond my usual single screen of just, here's a shortcut, it'll do this. Because this one is a shortcut, but I want to explain why you might actually want to use this particular shortcut. So this is color filters, which have been built into Windows for quite a while, and it will alter the screen colors to make the colors easier to distinguish. And it was first designed for, and it's especially helpful for those with color blindness. And there's three versions of color blindness: red-green, with the green being weak, which is due to retinopia, or red-green with red weak, and that's protanopia, or blue-yellow color blindness, tritanopia. In addition to that, you can also do grayscale, or grayscale inverted, or inverted color. So the hotkey for this is, or the keyboard shortcut, is Windows Control C, and it will be off by default. So it will not work for you unless you actually go in and turn this feature on. So to turn it on, you go to Settings, Accessibility, Color Filters. And I can't actually show the effect in the screen captures because the screen capture will grab the actual colors as opposed to what is being displayed on the monitor. So you can toggle it on there, and this will be where it's off by default. And so you toggle it on with that. And then this is available in recent versions of Windows 11. I'm not sure how far back it goes, but you can adjust the intensity or the color boost, and this only affects the three versions that are for color blindness. Then you choose what you want to adjust, either the three the color blindness ones or the grayscale inverted, or the color inverted. And it takes effect immediately. As soon as you click on one of those, you'll see the screen colors will change immediately. And you can preview the color adjustment on a color wheel or those little flower type things or the color swatches. You'll be able to see what the effect is right away. And then you have to decide whether you want that hotkey to actually work for you or not. And because we're onto computer basics on keyboard shortcuts, of course you want to turn this on. So some examples. So these are actually photographs of my screen because, again, I can't do it as a screen cap. So this is with no color filter. This is with the red-green with the red weak, and this is the way it would actually appear. Here's inverted colors, and here's grayscale. So how I use color filters, I'm a photographer. So as a photographer, I set the color filters to grayscale. Because what this allows me to do is I can quickly toggle off to see how a photo would look if I removed all the colors for it, in other words, turning it into a black and white image. So I have to think about every photograph that I look at, which I'm always going to be previewing in color. And so does removing the color enhance the photo, or does it actually detract from the photo? So something that's very worth noting on this as a photographer, a grayscale conversion here is going to desaturate all colors equally. But in any photo editing program, you should be able to do more sophisticated grayscale than that. And what you can do is actually have different colors converted to different grayscale levels. So, for example, you could have reds converted to a light gray, blues converted to a dark gray, or vice versa. You know, reds converted to a dark gray, and blues converted to a light gray. So, but color filters allows for that quick assessment to say whether colors are adding to the photo or detracting from the photo. So here's a couple of examples where I think color enhances the photos. So on the left-hand side is the full color image, and then on the right-hand side is grayscale. And I think that removing the colors took away a lot from those photos. On the other hand, here's some photos that I looked at, and I said that I thought the color distracts from the image. So again, on the left-hand side, full color, and the right-hand side, grayscale. And the boat at the top, some people might think that the colors actually enhance it. I was looking at the textures in the wood, and that's what I really wanted to have people concentrate on rather than the color of the wood. And the bottom one, we have a rather garish yellow shutters and doors and things like that, and I thought that detracted from the photo, and turning it into a black and white image actually was superior. And that's it.
Okay. Thank you, Chris. Okay, last week or a week before, I was asking for, I was sending messages out saying that the cupboard was bare for material for Q&A, and a number of people came up with stuff, thank you very much. And one of them was this question, or this suggestion, really, that could we provide an overview about geo-blocking and why it happens, what are the reasons for that, what methods are used, and how can it be bypassed. And we've talked about some of this stuff before, but it's actually interesting. The method used, I thought, was interesting. And if you notice here, the URL here, 178.whatever, that's actually an IP address from the UK. And so if that was geo-blocked, I wouldn't be able to access that from Canada, because my IP address is in Canada, and that IP address might be blocked because of geographical location. So geo-blocking. So what happens is basically people who are providing internet service, websites and video services, that kind of streaming services, they may not want to allow people everywhere to access the information. And sometimes it's just they want you to pay, and sometimes they don't have the rights to send it to you. So basically, barriers can be set up, and it's based on your location and essentially on your, usually on your IP address. And then the problems may be, like I said, that some of the content may only be licensed for consumption in a given country, so you can't see it from another country. You're not supposed to be able to see it from another country. Or there may be companies who are trying to market products in different areas of the world at different prices, maybe, and they don't want other people to know what's going on. And you can have restricted web pages and videos and streaming services and all that good stuff. So that's basically the internet content is being blocked because you're in the wrong, in quotation marks, geographical area. So how does the service provider know that I'm in Canada and they're in the UK and they're not going to let me see their stuff? Well, here's where it's kind of interesting. It turns out that IP addresses are basically assigned in blocks to various countries. And then certain organizations maintain databases which links the IP address to the geographical location. So that's usually the way that it's done. When they just check your IP address, they go look it up in this online database, and they decide that you can either receive the service or they're going to block you. Now, if you're using a mobile device, a phone or a tablet, then you may have a GPS active, which will tell them where your phone is, where you are essentially. Or if it's cell service, then they may be looking at different cell towers and figuring out where you are based on the signal that you're receiving on your cell phone. And then you can also use things like account details. And if you're on a particular service and you give them a shipping address in Ottawa, Ontario, it's a pretty good bet that's where you live, and so on and so forth. There are various ways of finding out where you are. So an example, a classic example, would be Netflix. You have a Netflix account. You can streamline all kinds of you can stream all kinds of content, television programs and so forth, on your TV set in your home in Ottawa, Ontario, or in Canada in general. However, you may find that you can't see some US shows that are available on Netflix. And that's because Netflix is allowed to show that content in the US, but it doesn't have the rights, the Canadian distribution rights, to show you the same videos in Canada. So Netflix is going to check your location, find out that you're located in Canada, and then it will decide that you can't see that thing, and it will probably show you a message that that is not available in your country, or whatever it says. The next thing is, can you circumvent geo-blocking? And we've talked about this previously. You can try using a VPN, and sometimes that will work around the geo-blocking, basically because you're in Canada, but you choose a server in the US or in the UK, wherever you're trying to receive the content from. And then as far as the service provider is concerned, it looks at your IP address, and the IP of your VPN is in the US or in UK. So it thinks, okay, that's fine, we can send in the content. So normally the content would be available if you were to use a VPN. Now, there's some problems with that. One of the things is you're probably circumventing or disobeying the terms of service that you signed up for with your internet service provider. You probably said you wouldn't do this. So the potential legal questions, certainly moral questions, if you're bending the rules, as it were. And the other thing is that even the VPN may not work. And because IP addresses are a limited commodity generally, some of the IP addresses that are used by VPNs may be well known, and the service providers may actually block those in certain instances. So you may be able to work around it, and you may not. But I think we've all come across geo-blocking, but that's basically what's happening. You're being looked up in a database, they figure out where you are, and they decide whether you can have the content or not. And that's all I have on that, Chris.
Okay, I had a couple of comments on that regarding geo-blocking. Tom says banks also geo-block or put more barriers up to protect clients. He advises to tell them your travel schedule. I commented back, I tried that once, told they had no means of recording that. And I asked if they did put any restriction based on geographic source, and they said they didn't know. So that wasn't terribly helpful. Tom also said they might also suspect VPN addresses as being something that is being done illicitly, I guess. Tom also said IP addresses have also been used, allocated to companies, including multinationals. Elizabeth says some parts of BBC are geo-blocked, and I've heard of that before. Tom says you could use a Tor browser, but unfortunately I think with Tor browser, the way it does is it bounces your signal or your traffic through multiple locations and then finally exits out, and you can't actually specify the exit node, so you couldn't use it to circumvent geo-blocking other than it's just, it may be a random country that it, your traffic is then appearing to come from, so I don't know that would be all that useful. And Stu says getting around geo-blocking has been the only selling point of the VPN companies for years. Now, they still try to sell VPN as being security, and I hate that because there's almost nothing to do with security when it comes to VPN. Very, very limited on that. It's really all about geo-blocking is what it's useful for. Tom says if we ever get IPv6, we may each have permanent IPs. Could be a good point. Still could be geo-blocked. OLG in Ontario. Checks your location to see that you are in Ontario. So that's interesting. So if you want to buy lottery tickets online in Ontario, you have to actually be located in Ontario or use a VPN, I guess.
One thing regarding VPNs, one of the reasons that they're more popular in the States is that in the States, IPs can sell your metadata, such as what IP addresses you're accessing. Maybe if they supply the DNS, they know what URLs you're doing. And if you use a VPN, then that is all obscured to them.
True. Yeah, if you don't trust your ISP. Yeah.
But then you have to trust your VPN.
That's true. You eventually have to trust somebody. So I probably would trust my ISP more than I would trust a random VPN supplier. I don't know.
OLG doesn't like VPNs. You can't do it.
Yeah. So VPNs have their... there's limited applicability, I guess, in terms of this.
Okay, well, as Chris said, we have time for questions. So now we're in the last 10. If anybody has any additional questions or question of things.
Instead of using a VPN in England, say, to get a BBC video or audio or whatever, if you had a friend that was in England, can you go through his IP address in England to get to the BBC instead of the VPN?
Sure. But he would have to set up the a server or a proxy that you would use.
Yeah, you'd have to connect to his computer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or you could do it for him so he can access all of the CDC content.
Exactly. Natalie says, is using VPN when out and about. Other option is public, not secure Wi-Fi. Most public Wi-Fi is not going to be secured because they don't want to deal with passwords and things like that. And so they're largely going to be open. Now, the reason why I don't personally think that, and that's the one very, very limited use case for a VPN, is that if you have traffic that is going from your computer that is not secure traffic, HTTPS traffic, then it is sniffable on the airwaves. But if you're using web, almost every web server you go to nowadays demands that you be on HTTPS. You're on a secure connection. So you have an encrypted tunnel from your computer to that other endpoint. Anyways, you know, you can't even use Google search without it being HTTPS. So it's only if you're using a service that is not encrypted end-to-end, and there may be some background services that you have running on your computer that might do that, but by and large, I think that virtually all of the communications from your computer are end-to-end encrypted, and so even being on an open Wi-Fi, you know, I don't think you're going to be at a high degree of risk of somebody sniffing your traffic.
Okay, Harvey's got his hand up, so we'll go to him next.
Yeah, the simplest thing you can do, Natalie, is on your cell phone, turn on your personal hotspot, and that'll give you the security.
That's true. Try to route all your – it's almost like a VPN, really. You're routing all your traffic through your phone and through your mobile connection rather than through the Wi-Fi hotspot. So
right.
If you have lots of traffic available to you, and certainly that's, yep, and lots of battery, sure. But that is a way of doing it.
Lots of data coverage on your phone.
Yeah.
Is that in the settings?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. And then you would connect to your phone rather than connecting to the open Wi-Fi.
They tether off the phone.
Yeah. That's correct, yeah. Look on your phone and find personal hotspot.
Okay, B has a hand up.
I have two quick questions. The first one, I have a friend who never uses his computer except at home, so he does not need that extra VPN that Bitdefender's trying to sell him, right?
I would say no. I would say it doesn't need it.
Okay. So, you do get some VPN with Bitdefender anyway, so this, the extra one is only if you're using it a lot. My second question is, when I went to sign in today using the way I always sign in with that short link that you guys give in the email, it would not let me sign in. I had to use the option, let's see, what was it called?
The wrong URL.
It said that... it wanted me to download the Zoom app, and I've never had to do that before, and I was afraid to do it because I do have Zoom on my computer. I'm assuming it's the Zoom app, and I use that, you know, for my teaching, and so I didn't want to screw it up. So I didn't want to download a new version, so I used the web version to sign in today, and it's all black. I hate that, but whatever. Is there something that has changed at your end, or is there something that has changed at my end why it doesn't work the way it did last week?
There's nothing that I've changed at our end. Did anybody use the tiny URL today and got in okay?
Could it have been when you were on another link and you were not getting through to us?
No, I wasn't.
No, Chris had it set up so that he was in another meeting. He was in the wrong Zoom meeting. So we
that was only the first. That was at 6 or 7 15 to 717 or something like that.
Okay. No, I went back out while someone was talking, which is very rude of me, and tried again. and I got the same, I had the same problem. It let me sign in using a web browser. I think that's the option it says. But it wouldn't let me sign in the way I usually do, which is just to click on the tiny URL and it does its thing.
I haven't heard from anybody else having similar problems. So
okay.
If all else fails, reboot.
I've encountered that before. You went to link, eventually it went by way of the web instead of by the application.
Uh-huh.
It asked me to download stuff and everything else. Eventually, I just closed it down. I just went directly by way of the... Ever since then, I pretty much go straight to the application and enter the actual code manually instead of by any link. But that's the way
Oh, so you go to your Zoom application.
Yes.
And open that and enter the link. Okay.
Yeah, you don't enter the link, okay? If you go into the app, we do provide the meeting ID and the password.
Right.
And so you would put that into the Zoom app. So that should work always.
Okay. I just don't want to take any chances with my Zoom because it's
It is
so delicate. It just it can mess you up so badly if you tinker with it, or every time they update, there's something goes wrong.
Yeah. So go into the app, say join a meeting, and put in the credentials.
Okay. Is there a problem joining the way I did, which is the web join?
No, that should work too. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks. Sorry about
Natalie
all that.
Natalie has her hand up next.
Yeah, just a follow up. So when I went to my phone settings, I didn't see a personal hotspot, but in the advanced settings, there's a Wi-Fi network thing, hotspot 2.0. So it says automatically connect to hotspot 2.0 Wi-Fi networks. Is that?
It should be under your network settings. Are you on Android?
Yeah.
Yeah, in Android, I believe it's under network. You should have an option there for a personal hotspot. I can just see if I can see quickly.
You should be able to go into settings and enter in hotspot. And then
I did, and that's... Yeah, so I got two things. I got either the hotspot 2.0, that, or mobile hotspot and tethering.
That would be it, mobile hotspot and tethering.
Oh. Okay.
How to use a hotspot would be a great share for next week, hint, hint.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's trivial.
All right, trivial share for next week.
That's
next
fine.
Okay, David has his hand up next.
Just a... follow-up comment? Yes, Zoom just did another update yesterday.
Oh, okay.
So that could be part of the problem. It went from 7.0 to 7.1, I believe.
Okay. All right. So that might be it.
Okay, Jocelyn.
Yes, I just wanted to explain a little bit something about the power pack, because often there is two numbers. There is the voltage and there is the current, and the two are easily confused. In the case of the voltage, this has to match. The computer and the power pack has to match, where the current is something that changes. So depending on the load of the computer or how many power supply, how many hard drive and all what you're doing, the current can vary a lot. So if you look on the label of the computer, it says, let's say, 5 amp. It means that the computer will use up to 5 amp. But it could be a lot less. Same thing on the power supply. It's the reverse. The power supply has to be able to provide at least 5 amp. So if you have a big power pack that does 10 amps, that's fine because it will cover 5 amp. So that's what I'm saying is the current on the computer is the max, on the power supply is the min. So, but the voltage has to match. 12 volt has to be 12 volt. 5 volt has to be 5 volt. But the current is the max on the device that uses the power, the computer, and the 5 amp has to be able to provide the 5 amp on the power pack.
The other thing you'd have to watch for, if you have a barrel connector on the the power supply where it plugs into the computer. Make sure that you have, like, it could be positive on the outside or positive on the inside. So you want to make sure those match.
Right.
How do you tell that?
Yeah, you'd have to look up the spec of the actual power supply. It will actually tell you whether it'll have a little indicator, positive on the inside or the outside, or negative on inside or outside. It'll actually specify that. The other way of getting the match would be to look up online. If you're looking to buy a power supply, is say, you know, power supply 4, and specify the exact make and model, and it should get the match correctly.
Okay, all right, so Tom has volunteered to do hotspots next week. Thanks, Tom, and we'll look forward to that. In the meantime, talking about the COVID being bare on QA items, the cupboard is pretty well empty in terms of articles for the newsletter. So Bridget, our hardworking newsletter editor, will start putting together newsletters again for the coming season. In a few weeks, September issue, I think, will be the next one. So that will come out in mid to late August. So if you have any bright ideas on articles that you'd like to write for the newsletter, and there's the email address to contact Bridget. She'll be happy to receive your copy and showcase your work to the world. There we go. And next up I have, favorite applications. We've talked about this before too. If you have an application for Windows or Linux or Android that you use all the time and you think would be of interest to somebody else, we're always interested to hear about it. Just a short presentation, a few slides, a few minutes is good enough to just give us the basics. And 5 to 10 minutes, let's say, just tell us a little bit about it, how it works, why you actually use it, and no doubt other people will be interested to hear about it and maybe try it as well. And if you're not good at making slides, Chris and I have made a few slide presentations in our lives, and if you can't do it, we're available to help. So basically, just tell us what you want to present and maybe just an outline in text, and we'll put together some beautiful slides for you. Won't we, Chris?
Yes, and we'd be happy to share them with you before they go to Q&A so you can validate that it's what you wanted presented.
There you go. Okay, and talking about next Q&A, next Wednesday is August the 5th will be our next Q&A. So if you have new questions, if you have follow-ups on things we've talked about tonight, if you have topics that you would like to share, if you have things that you want Chris and I to prepare slides for, send us an email to our suggestion box address and we'll be happy to accommodate you. In the meantime, I hope everybody enjoyed the material tonight. Good discussion. Thanks for the input and we'll see you next week.
Thanks, everyone. See you next week.